Hi, I'm Josephine Ensign, author of Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, and my new book, due out in November, Way Home, Journeys Through Homelessness. For the past 40 years, I've worked as a nurse practitioner, providing primary care to people experiencing poverty and homelessness. I have the lived experience of homelessness as a young adult. I live and work in Seattle, a city with our nation's third highest number of people experiencing homelessness. Only New York City and Los Angeles have higher numbers. The Skid Road podcast aims to amplify a diversity of voices about homelessness in the Seattle area. Beginning in 2015, when a state of emergency was declared for homelessness in our city and county, I've done a series of oral history interviews with local people living and working at the intersection of health and homelessness. Public health nurses, emergency department physicians, politicians, heads of nonprofit agencies, activists, and frontline staff. People who've not only endured homelessness, but who are now housed and are working on creative solutions to homelessness. I've learned a lot from my conversations with all of these people, and I want to share their insights with you. On a semi-weekly basis, I'll post a new podcast episode featuring these conversations, interspersed with some of my own reflections. Learn more about this project through my Medical Margins website. Please subscribe to this podcast and share it with others. Thanks for listening. All right. So I'm Josephine Ensign here today with Casey Troopin, and it's Wednesday, March 6, 2024. So Casey, as we were talking before, this is for the Skid Road Oral History Project, and thank you so much for being part of it. So the first question I have for you, I mean, you know, we've worked together way back in the dawn of time, at least my time here in Seattle. But what led you to the work that you do?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. And thank you. It's great to be here. It's always nice to be with old friends and have people who've been here for a long time. You know, I think certainly when I was growing up in Seattle, you saw examples of homelessness and homelessness among young people on the Ave most noticeably. Mm-hmm. It wasn't something that I necessarily had a lot of proximity to, but as I got older and went to school with young people that clearly were experiencing housing instability, it struck me as something that was particularly incomprehensible. As a middle-class kid growing up in Seattle. And when I was in college, I saw a lot more of it in Los Angeles and then was spending time in Latin America where it was really in your face and it became even more confusing, I would say, to understand how we could let especially young people, but anybody, be without a home. And it was something that I couldn't really let go of. I had stability. I had housing stability. I had family stability, certainly as compared to those young people that I saw on the streets, and got some opportunities then to study more about why it was happening in Latin America and Los Angeles. Got an opportunity to volunteer just nearby at the University District Youth Center one mm-hmm. summer as part of a VISTA volunteer, AmeriCorps VISTA volunteer program, and got to work a lot with young people who were sleeping in the parks that night but were coming to the University District Youth Center because they wanted to learn. They found it to be a safe place. And my parents had worked with young people. They had, I think, impressed upon me that it was important to understand that the circumstances that we grow up in are not necessarily the same as others, and we should strive to understand that people come from different circumstances, that we're really privileged. And this to me seemed like one of the best ways to understand that more, to understand my relative privilege and to do what I think my whole family felt, which was to use that privilege to help other people who purely by luck of the draw hadn't grown up with housing stability. Mm-hmm. I found, and I still find, homelessness among young people to be one of the most confounding yet best examples of how we've created a system that doesn't serve young people well. So that was the start, really, was volunteering at the University District Youth Center, working on homelessness as a senior in college. And then I spent a year, luckily, in Latin America, traveling from country to country. I had a fellowship to understand how communities were responding to homelessness mm-hmm. among young people. So I went from Mexico all around Latin America down to Peru and Colombia, looking at what the responses were of communities to young people living on the streets. And it was somewhat different from country to country, but there was a common theme of both a lack of humanity and intense humanity, the lack of humanity that young people were being slaughtered across various countries because they were interfering with business interests. Mm-hmm. They were interfering with tourism. Right, exactly. That that they were represented something that people who had power, and in this case guns, didn't want to see. That was the lack of humanity. The humanity that I saw was among people who lived there for the most part and those who worked with young people, an incredible understanding of these young people were no different than their own children and deserved the same supports and the same opportunities. And our collective role was to make sure that that had happened. And I truly believe that I went down there with, I think, a pre-programmed idea of, well, the United States does things better mm-hmm. than other countries, and came back with it flipped. That in large part the way that those countries or those communities had responded, aside from the, you know, obviously the slaughtering of young people, the way that organizations had responded was so far beyond where the U.S. was. Concepts of housing first, concepts of meeting young people where they are, concepts I think even of involving people with lived experience mm-hmm. at all levels of the response were so far beyond what I was seeing in Seattle and Los Angeles.
And that was about what years?
That would have been 1995 and 1996. Okay. I mean, obviously concepts of housing first existed, but they weren't I wasn't seeing those kind of things in the youth homelessness mm-hmm. space as much. It wasn't as readily apparent as it was in the way that I was seeing Guatemala respond or Colombia respond. And it flipped my mind, I think, about actually some of the ways we've developed systems in the United States that have actually hindered us mm-hmm. around youth homelessness. So that was the start.
Right.
Luckily, when I was in law school, after that, the law school itself was trying to be a better neighbor, as was the whole university.
Was that here?
That was here. Yeah, okay. Here at University of Washington School of Law. And so the law school was trying to figure out how they could use their legal skills to mm-hmm. be more helpful, given that youth homelessness was so apparent right on its doorstep. And it was creating a program to train law students to be helpful, whether it was creating information or referral materials or linking young people on the streets with legal help, with actual attorneys. There were attorneys for some of these young people. There weren't for a lot of their issues because their issues were so distinct and so apart from the systems that we had set up. But the effort was great, and I think we were able to bring some attention to the issue and really bring attention to the fact that youth homelessness is such an intersectional issue that it defied the way that we had created legal systems. Young people weren't juvenile offenders. They weren't foster kids. They weren't, undocumented, unaccompanied young people. They were all of these things, but it really depended on chronology, and it was so intersectional that the way we had created the legal system really failed these young people because it would pick off one of their issues and leave five of them remaining. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to create a program that was much more intersectional, that could meet young people where they were and help them, I think, across the board. And I think the legal system has struggled because it thinks of people as their issue as opposed to people as really people caught up in a lot of different legal systems.
Mm-hmm.
So that led to then me working on that, and I got a fellowship at Columbia Legal Services. That would have been in 1999 to work on establishing that program, which at that point was called Street Youth Legal Advocates of Washington. Got a 2-year fellowship to represent young people experiencing homelessness. And the cases were all over the board. They were family law cases where young people were in a domestic violence situation and losing their child, or they were the child themselves in a family law situation. And the outcome of the case meant they would either experience housing stability or not, or a public benefits issue or a trust issue. An education issue, collateral consequences of having been arrested. It really was all over the board, and it was fascinating to me and depressing. And just as much, it was inspiring because once we had gotten legal issues out of the way, young people were able to do incredible things with their lives. And the realization that the legal system was really, in large part, one of the major barriers to them actually getting housing and stability was tremendous, I think, both for me but for other folks in the judicial system, in the legal system, and elsewhere.
And that's about the time, I think, that you and I worked together with the health department, with some of the youth, homeless youth serving clinics in the area, including 45th Street Homeless Youth Clinic, to try to figure out the state laws around the legal kinds of ramifications and parameters for young people seeking different kinds of health care.
Yeah.
And what can you say about that? I mean, you and I were chatting a bit before this that it's an ongoing issue.
Yeah, I think that in part is a great example of what I was talking about earlier, that as you knew better than anyone, the access to healthcare often was the key to stability for mm-hmm. that young person. Whether or not they were able to get healthcare didn't just matter for their actual physical well-being. It mattered for whether they were going to be able to sustain living in a place or return mm-hmm. to a place.
Or having the appropriate place.
Or having an appropriate place, absolutely. And it mattered beyond that as well. It often mattered for employment or getting to school or being safe in other ways. And so whether or not we could make it clear that young people could access healthcare became such a big issue, not just for the healthcare system, mm-hmm. but for housing and education and employment and really the rest of their lives. And I remember certainly sitting with you and others and trying to figure this out and trying to figure out a path forward on a law that essentially was unclear, mm-hmm. had not been written with these young people in mind. Had not been written with these young people being involved, mm-hmm. which probably would have solved it had young people been there at the table.
Or also people working with them from the healthcare.
Or absolutely. Yeah. Great point. You know, it the way we were – and still to some extent do – the way we were writing laws was mm-hmm. done without regard to that, without talking about the professionals from groups that aren't well represented in – creation of laws, and then those people themselves. So the law wasn't clear about which young people could access healthcare and when. I think what was special about that group was the group was all aligned around we need to make this as assertive and aggressive and clear as possible, mm-hmm. And not that we wanted to center it around the young person who was seeking access to healthcare, not around the system that was trying to figure out whether or not they could provide that healthcare. Mm-hmm. And that made a big difference, I think, because when the perspective is, how do you make sure that young people get what they need? You come up with a different answer, I think, than when the question is, how do you make sure that the healthcare system is functioning mm-hmm. how it's intended.
Or protecting them from lawsuits or angry parents.
And... Sure. Right. Right. And in fact, so we all came up with a set of documents that I think had a pretty big effect in mm-hmm. terms of making healthcare providers feel, for the most part, that they could provide services to young people in really critical circumstances when they needed it. And that was a big success and a big eye opener, I think, for me that a lot could be done in between making new laws mm-hmm. and representing individual mm-hmm. clients.
The translation.
The translation is absolutely critical, particularly for this population that is just – there were very few laws specifically about youth experiencing homelessness at the time. Mm-hmm. Really very, very few. I can think of a handful. Now the landscape is completely different. But what was necessary was an elevation of young people in this circumstance have particular legal needs that laws written without regard to that are not going to serve those needs. And you saw through folks like Jim Theophilus and others, then a slow ramp up and then an explosion of laws that particularly focused on young people experiencing homelessness. And now Washington mm-hmm. probably has the clearest and the highest number of laws around young people experiencing homelessness that are intended to promote access and stability mm-hmm. because collectively the community raised awareness that you couldn't craft a law that was intended for kids like I was in middle school and then think it would apply to somebody who had lost one of their basic needs.
Right. And then there was the Becca bill.
And then there was the Becca bill.
And it's being phased out this year. Is that correct?
It is. The last remnants of it, I would say, or among the last remnants of it, are being slowly phased out. And, you know, I think like many things, it came from an understandable place.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
You know, as parents, we think about our kids and you know, what needs to happen when they've lost control or it seems like they've lost control and the shock of seeing young people on the streets or the movie Streetwise mm-hmm.
And the murder, especially young.
And the murder of Becca Hedman and all of that. And we respond in ways that are understandable but short-sighted.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we ultimately did was largely criminalize running away in that effort. We took a snippet of Becca Hedman's story rather than the whole story and designed law
it's
around that.
It's a lot more complex.
It sure is. And we ended up – and this is exactly what we've done in homelessness writ large. We ended up making things worse.
Mm-hmm.
We may have made things better in a short term and felt like it was a success, but we created in some ways a – generation of young people who were more traumatized,
mm-hmm.
less
fearful.
Trusting
yes.
of adults, of systems, more incentivized to go into the shadows
mm-hmm.
and into situations where they were even more unsafe. Our intent was not to do that. I say, I didn't pass the law and I spent a lot of time fighting against it. But it became this, I think, push and pull of either or of either we're going to lock a bunch of kids up until they get the point. And I remember sitting in court with kids where, you know, they were being locked up for running away and being told to do things that seems like things I would come up with as a parent, but had no basis and, you know, write an essay about how bad the foster care system is or how you're going to end up dead when you know, if you keep running away.
Oh, nice.
And that was the court's response. And all these well-meaning people of like, well, this is, you know, sometimes you could tell in the judge's voice that they were re-experiencing the trauma of their own,
mm-hmm.
of raising their own adolescents. Mm-hmm. But rarely was it based in anything in terms of how we were responding to young people who were living trauma. And running away from something or experiencing deep substance use disorder or their parents' substance use disorder, often both. Not often both, but sometimes that was the case. So I think we've come a long ways knowing that there are ways that partly that these are complicated issues, that responding to kids in a punitive way is a great way of creating a generation mm-hmm. of young people who now we know studies show that when we respond that way, you're creating a pathway directly to adult homelessness that is so clear. 40 to 50% of adults who are categorized, and I don't love this term, but as experiencing chronic homelessness, mm-hmm. first experience as a young person.
Exactly.
And it wasn't them that made their path to adult homelessness clear. It was the way we responded. Mm-hmm. And BECA, the BECA laws, the BECA bill were a great way of, in a short-sighted way, making that path stronger mm-hmm. and clearer. And I wouldn't be surprised if some of that is responsible for the numbers of young adults and adults mm-hmm. that are experiencing chronic homelessness now. In fact, if we talk to them, I'm sure a lot of them – actually, I would be stunned if you take out those who were veterans. I would be stunned if there were that many of them who did not experience mm-hmm. the foster care system, homelessness as a young person, the juvenile legal system. Those paths seem to be relatively clear. There are other pathways, but there's a strong pathway that we're responsible for.
That's a really good point. And I don't think those questions are included, for instance, in the new and improved point in time count mm-hmm. At King County level. Those would be good because they do a lot of qualitative research now.
They do.
Or not research, but trying to understand a little bit more. That's a good point. So tell me, I think I have similar reservations about the term, but tell me from your perspective, your reservations about the term chronic homelessness.
Yeah, I think I sometimes bristle at throwing out words that do a good job of describing things solely because they've been used to describe something that's negative. But for me, the historical way that I've heard chronic homelessness described, not necessarily by those in the field, but by others, is a blaming mm-hmm. type usage that it's intractable. Those two things. Mm-hmm. If something is chronic,
you're going to live with it.
You're going to be there. It's all about mitigation,
yes.
Right? You have chronic fatigue. You have a chronic cough. You have
It's medical. It's medicalization.
Yeah, absolutely. Term. And so. I think to some extent the way I've heard it used is in a way about us getting off the hook, mm-hmm. not being responsible as a community for doing something about that. So I don't love that, but I get that we do need a term that describes a particular experience of long-term homelessness mm-hmm. that happens repeatedly. I use it because it's meaningful. It has a specific legal meaning. It's meaningful for services. Mm-hmm. I would say the other reason I bristle a little bit, this is less about the term, but more about the concept, is that we need to support people who are experiencing chronic homelessness. It's critical. It is the humane thing to do. We have done a terrible job of creating a prevention system.
Yes.
And the focus only on chronic homelessness has led us to create solutions that will not actually fully get us out of any issue. Mm-hmm. The fact that that's always going to be people's focus of it's what's in front of my face. It's the person I see on the way to work. It's the person I see on the way to my kid's bus stop. It's the person who's making me scared or making me bristle or whatever. The idea of it is uncomfortable.
Right, taking the most money.
Absolutely. That's who I'm going to call my council member about. And that's perfectly understandable that people respond that way. And our political system is set up to only respond to that because that's the thing that people want to see happen in 2 years or 4 years. But it's not the thing that's going to get us out of the issue ultimately. There's just no example of anybody really fully addressing homelessness, and particularly youth homelessness, without paying significant attention to inflow mm-hmm. and to prevention.
Although I would push back a little bit and ask you your perspective on this, but programs like, again, what Jim Theophilus has started and spun off of, like, Way Home, that is, at least from my understanding of it, focusing on prevention.
In part, it is. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But probably just too small and to make a big difference.
Well, as of today, I believe it was today, the state has released a report showing that since 2016, the state has reduced youth homelessness by 40%.
That's good.
And that's massive. And they've rerun the numbers and used, I think, much more comprehensive data and showing that I should not quote data without looking at it, but that we've gone from about 24,000 young people experiencing homelessness in our state every year down to 14,000. That's 10,000 fewer
a
year.
Yeah.
And if you take that out, then if you think about half of those young people potentially going on to experiencing it as an adult, that's a massive impact for the system as a whole. And so what they're saying, and certainly I would agree, is that part of that is about prevention. Mm-hmm. And we actually have done a better job of preventing that approaches like having systems think about where young people are going to go when they leave systems of care.
Or
that
even
matters.
Like school system.
So, and the enhanced role of a school system, which is really the best way of preventing. I mean, if we focus on schools, it's probably the best way of preventing youth homelessness from happening. And so I think that that is showing really big impact. And I think we have made gains by just focusing on chronic homelessness. But I don't think that those gains are sustainable or will last. And I don't think those gains are equitable when we don't think about the front end of the system. Because the front end of the system is always going to be the thing that creates the most inequities in terms of race, in terms of sexual orientation and gender identity. And to think that we, in the back end, by helping people experiencing homelessness, can reverse that, I think is a fallacy. So for reasons of equity, for reasons of sustainability and efficiency, we have to have a system that's balanced, looking at the back end of the system and the front end of the system.
Yeah, not ignoring.
Yeah.
Yeah, because just from a, kind of a cold, hard cost-benefit analysis, especially focusing more on younger people to help prevent it, has more long-term benefits for them as well as society. And that's always difficult, right? Because we don't want to say, oh, the older, chronically homeless, forget about them. But
We can do it all.
I think. Oh, yes.
This is, and I think that the idea that we couldn't has led us to only focus on crisis response, not enough on affordable housing, not enough on for young people. What are the financial supports or other supports we could give families, whether it's the family that young person has grown up with or the family that they are now living with, the aunt, the coach, the neighbor. We actually can focus on that. There's got to be always with these systems change a moment where the prevention and the crisis response are both existing at a maybe at a higher level than you actually need them to be. And then you figure out how to right size that. But I'm convinced, and I think the 40% drop in Washington State is a good example of that, that we can actually hit both ends of these systems. And then what you would want to see is that prevention becomes a much, much bigger part of this.
Right.
And crisis response withers away because there's just not a lot of people experiencing homelessness.
Yes.
That's so my dream.
Yeah,
that's my
dream. It's a good dream. So tell me more about like what you're doing now with the Rakes Foundation.
So I was with Columbia Legal Services for 16 years, went from representing young people in individual cases to really realizing that even there, we could represent as many young people as possible. But if the systems didn't change, all we were doing there was crisis response as well, that we needed to change the system so that young people weren't experiencing homelessness in the first place. So my job really, I think, transformed into bigger cases around foster care, and then legislative work as well to help craft the laws that made a difference. And, you know, one of those that I got to do actually with some support from the Rakes Foundation was to help put into place what young people said was the most important thing that they saw as a systemic failure. And when that question was asked to a group of young people from Mockingbird and other organizations, if you were to change one thing about the way the state operated around youth homelessness, this was in 2015, young people said, we have no idea who at the state level is actually responsible for youth homelessness.
Right.
And it was so obvious once they said it that the foster care system was saying these aren't really the kids that we're serving. Mm-hmm. The school system said those aren't really our kids. You know, healthcare was saying, well, when they show up, they're our kids, but just for that moment in time when we're providing services. The juvenile justice system, to its credit, was like, we don't want these kids. Mm-hmm. And so policy and funding decisions were, again, being made the same way we described everything else without attention to the specific situation of youth experiencing homelessness. And so so I was brought in to help write a law creating the Office of Homeless Youth, which I think has played an outsized role in why we've gone down 40%. Mm-hmm. Because we have had attention to it, thoughtful policy. They've included young people in crafting that policy. We have an incredible, envious system here where state is taking some responsibility for this issue, and you've got an incredibly strong outside partnership that is agitating for change, mm-hmm. that is holding the state accountable, and that is bringing the experiences of young people forth in crafting legislation. So, all that is to say, I did that. I became more acquainted with the Rakes Foundation. The story is something like I kept going to meetings with them, asking them for money over and over again.
And they decided to pay.
They kept saying no. They said, yeah. And when the I tend to go anywhere that somebody will give me free food. I never left that behind after being a VISTA volunteer. But the foundation was saying, we probably will be able in a position to give you money for your systems reform work when we build up that part of our strategy. Mm-hmm. The foundation itself had really gotten into this work in the same way that a lot of folks do, which is you see the kind of visceral, oh, there's a young person mm-hmm. on the Ave, or, you know, and that looks like somebody I can know, like somebody I know, my kid, my, you know, the valedictorian at the high school, they look familiar mm-hmm. to me. That kind of proximity, and they had gotten into the space of like, well, then how do we help young people who are experiencing homelessness get stable housing? So they had developed a strategy around that, particularly in King County. And they had been told, I think, over and over again by Mockingbird Society and other folks, well, it's really about the intersection between the systems. So mm-hmm. you need to build up a strategy that thinks about schools, the justice system, behavioral health, et cetera, et cetera. And so they told me over these multiple free lunches, just wait, ask for money when we develop that part mm-hmm. of our portfolio that talks about intersectional systems. I never did get that money, but I did, right? I got the money in a different way. I got hired on to lead that part yeah. of the work, which was to help create that. So over the years, we've done that work of building, I think, a more mature strategy around systems change. What that required was thinking about all the state systems, but it also required thinking about the federal system mm-hmm, as well. Mm-hmm. A lot of the funding that was coming in from the feds. Some of the laws that that were either leading to homelessness or making it better were also happening at that level. So we created a four initiative approach that operated at the national, state, and local level. And I'll say that youth homelessness in the funders world is a teeny, teeny world.
Yes.
It's not a big issue. And it's completely not commensurate with the size of the population. Mm-hmm. And I'm sheepish about saying this, but we now know some of the funding we invested about doing a better count. 4.2 million young people experience homelessness every year. Mm-hmm. 4.2 million. Now, our foster care system is about one-tenth that. The kids in foster care are the system's broken. It's a mess. a lot of work needs to be done, and young people leave that system often more broken to, you know, if we can call anybody broken, but more traumatized. So the tension is rightfully there. But if you were counting on numbers, you'd think of, at that point, you'd think of 10 times as much funding maybe in youth homelessness if there's, and the amount of attention to youth homelessness is teeny. And part of the reason why is they're so invisible. The issue is so invisible. Mm-hmm. And so we have demonized homelessness so much that I think that spills over to young people where we see those young people as the adolescents or the young adults that we don't want to have anything to do with. The kid with the piercings, the kid with the tattoos, you know, the kid who doesn't follow normal conventions, the overlay of racism and transphobia and homophobia is right there too. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it became, we were able to, because there weren't a lot of people in the field, have a, I think, an outsized influence on the way things operate. So at the foundation now, we have expanded. We are focused way more on prevention. How do we help support a system of prevention both in King County, but at the state level? I think that's going incredibly well. We are seeing programs pop up. We're seeing funding from the legislature. We're seeing the state invest in prevention in a way that it never has before. And at the federal level, I was just in D.C. last week, the amount of talk and attention to preventing youth homelessness and the belief that we can actually do something there is massive. And I think at the foundation, we're able to help that because we can create spaces where people can talk about it. We can offer funding to federal partners to actually staff it up. We can offer funding to advocates to continue banging on doors to say prevention, prevention, prevention. So that's one part of our strategy, is to make sure that prevention assumes a role that is the right size, that ultimately can help the crisis response system wither away, because people don't experience homelessness in the first place. The second part of our strategy, to your point around schools, is around student homelessness. Mm-hmm. Two things that I think we know about homelessness in schools. One is that actually there's more than two, but young people who experience homelessness graduate at incredibly low rates. Mm-hmm. It's young people experiencing homelessness, young people who are in the foster care system, and young people in the justice system have the lowest rates of graduation. It's not the same as experiencing, as being low income. It's much, much deeper. The trauma, the mobility, all of that makes it a much more pervasive issue. And there's just not a lot of attention being given to those students. And if we can make sure that they graduate, there is a correlation between a young person not graduating or not getting their GED and experiencing homelessness as a young adult. It's probably the biggest correlation between anything in young adult homelessness is not getting a GED and not getting a high school diploma. So if we can equip our schools and our families to help that young person walk across the graduation stage, we're actually reducing young adult homelessness and thus reducing homelessness across the board. The last part is that schools are probably the best situated institution to do something about prevention. Mm-hmm. Every kid goes there. They're in every community.
If they're lucky, they have a school nurse.
If they're lucky, they have a school nurse who can play an incredible role in prevention. If they're lucky, they have a counselor who's doing more than just career counseling. Mm-hmm. If they're lucky, the school is actually involved in the community in a way that if they know something is going on with that kid who keeps showing up with the same clothes over and over again, that kid who keeps asking for food, that you can take an action at that point and do something beyond just giving that kid an apple, that you can connect that kid and their family to services. And we've seen internationally, schools take a really assertive approach to finding out what's going on with every kid in their school and connecting them and their families to services at that moment, not waiting until that kid has some serious healthcare issue, that kid is living on the streets, that kid is running away from home, et cetera, et cetera.
Or the family connections are so broken.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that's a theme throughout, is that most young people tell a story of this pathway that it's not like the family connections, although it does happen, but generally the family connections fray until they break. Mm-hmm. And there were moments along there where we could have gone in and strengthened those family connections, whether, again, it was their biological parents or their adoptive parents or that aunt or uncle. We're finding that there's a lot we can do. Mm-hmm. Young people often don't show up at Orion Center the day after they leave home. It's usually they go to somebody else's house.
They couch surf.
They feel guilty because they feel like they're draining resources, mm-hmm. even if that adult is saying you're not. And there's moments there where we can intervene, and schools can play a huge role in that. And that's got to be part of our prevention system, this idea that we can actually stabilize the living situations for young people. But it's an American system that what we actually have created for adults as well is let's wait until you're living under a bridge mm-hmm. and you've mm-hmm. been there for a year until we actually take steps to intervene. And then we get all upset because we're like, why is it not working? And why wouldn't that person take what I'm offering them? You know, well, we've failed to intervene at the points when they would have, accepted things that were, that we thought were okay. And so we really have nobody but ourselves to blame. And it's so true with young people that we have, in fact, incentivized young people. People working in shelters talk about this all the time. Sometimes they're telling young people, you got to go sleep mm-hmm, under a bridge mm-hmm. until we can actually get you services.
Or to get into treatment.
Yeah. Or, right, same thing with treatment. So schools are the antidote in some ways to that, as well as services to community and culturally relevant services and the healthcare system, which is mm-hmm. also ubiquitous. It's everywhere. If we can get to young people and then we can actually offer them and their families something at the earliest possible moment, so much of this gets resolved, I think. The third strategy is our oldest strategy, which is crisis response. And we don't invest much in that anymore. But we do think that there are some common themes around how communities respond to people, young people who are already experiencing homelessness. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, it's not much different than adults. Obviously, you're connecting to different systems, but we need to know who that young person is experiencing homelessness and what their actual needs mm-hmm. are. We need to identify them.
In a nice way.
Absolutely. So we can offer something that actually matches their mm-hmm. needs. It's the same thing we often don't do in adult homelessness. We say, here's a 50-bed shelter. Mm-hmm. Here's what you need. We don't really know anything about them. We're not involving them in the discussion about the solution. And so in crisis response, knowing every young person in a nice way, making sure that we have the right entryway to them getting housing stability and having a great data system as well so that we can actually figure out what's working and mm-hmm. not just have a one-size-fits-all approach. And we see that working, I think, throughout Washington State mm-hmm. and other places in the community. And sometimes we see better responses in rural communities because they haven't built up a system that actually doesn't function well. So mm-hmm. they're not dismantling at the same time as they're building up.
Yeah, they have
sometimes you don't. Sometimes you don't see that. Then the fourth one is really what is the support we as a foundation we need to give and other foundations to create the enabling environment mm-hmm. for all of this to happen. And in that, we know we need to make sure that young people are at the table, which is a hard thing to do. We need to have a strong advocacy community. We need to have sufficient research out there. We need to have good messaging. We also think that we need to have more leadership that is reflective of the communities that we're actually serving. Mm-hmm. So we're funding at all of these levels to make that happen. And I think creating the enabling environment, as we call it, in kind of a cold way, to see those changes happen is incredibly important. And we think that's a lot of why Washington State, I think, is making progress, is that the outside frenemy, as we call them, to the state's efforts is mm-hmm. so strong, so robust that you would never go to Olympia and not hear about youth homelessness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that helps everybody, not just the young people. The parents are guardians that are really trying their hardest, everything else in the community.
Yeah.
So tell me, if you can, are there any kind of rural or suburban or exurban kinds of areas that are doing a particularly good job?
Well, I think there are pieces where we see rural communities doing a good job. Shelton always stands out to me in one of those examples, because what they did was they created a in the high school there, in the alternative high school, they have basically a drop-in center in the school. Mm-hmm. It's not labeled as a homeless youth drop-in mm-hmm. center. It's really we're the problem solvers. So young people go in and they go upstairs. The homeless liaison is there or connected to it, but the all of the services are there and they're connecting. They're doing problem solving with young people there because they don't have a robust shelter or a bunch of you know, other options for people to go to. They've had to be creative in kind of problem solving. How do you match young people doing problem solving with cash to actually mm-hmm. make that happen? We saw that example. Walla Walla has, with the help of Away Home Washington and the Anchor Community Initiative, has done a good job, really good job. They don't have a lot of beds either, mm-hmm. Of doing things like involving the school in the response, but also the state has developed an incredibly strong diversion program. And diversion in this context means how do you take motivational interviewing, kind mm-hmm. of helping a young person come up with a solution, mm-hmm. and then flexible funding to solve that.
To meet that.
Yeah, to meet that need. And it's been – the data on that has been unreal. It's been so effective in both preventing youth homelessness and in addressing it. Mm-hmm. And it's – empowering to young people because that's the solution they've come up with. It's not for everybody. It's not going to solve every problem, but it's also working just as well, if not better, for youth of color than mm-hmm. it is for white youth. Mm-hmm. So you've got this incredible. So places like Walla Walla, I think, are able to use that and deploy that exceptionally well because they've created the structures where young people are coming for help and trusting who they're coming to. Mm-hmm. So that Walla Walla is another example. I think we're hearing nationally about other places like Gulf Coast, Mississippi, that are really doing a good job of tackling youth homelessness. And again, I think we created a system that was crisis response heavy out of all the humanity in the world, and that's mm-hmm. the only thing we knew how to do. But now building back from that and making sure there's enough of the prevention is sometimes harder to do for communities where we have a robust crisis response system and it's seen as a zero-sum game mm-hmm. that we need to take money from shelters.
Right, and jobs.
And it shouldn't be that. We can't do that. We cannot dismantle a crisis response system.
We need it.
We absolutely 100% need it. Someday I hope we don't need it. And I see – we've seen internationally sometimes where – they start to dismantle that system because they actually have created a good prevention mm-hmm. system. We heard in Canada, in Niagara, I think the community is called Niagara, where as a result of instituting a pretty good prevention system, fewer and fewer young people were showing up to mm-hmm. the shelter. And there was some tension there about why was the head of the shelter trying to push for a big prevention system? Because in effect, he was dismantling the system mm-hmm. that they had built up. And he said, just stick with me. And they transformed the way they did work to being much more of a prevention oriented. But you could not do that. We cannot leave young people out on the streets mm-hmm. or adults at all. We have to be able to do both. And it's not really that expensive to do.
Right.
And it's ultimately, it's a conservative's dream. It's a progressive's dream that – from the conservative's perspective, this is how we get to an efficient and economically efficient system. From a progressive's perspective, we can actually end homelessness. Mm-hmm. We can do it in a way that's equitable and humane.
Yeah, and end suffering,
yeah.
or at least reduce
Absolutely.
It significantly.
For sure. No yeah. doubt about it.
So looking at the time yeah. for you, because I know you gotta head out to something, but were there any lessons from the pandemic, kind of like positive ones that you can speak to?
Yeah, I think there were. I think that, as you know well, the pandemic resulted in people doing things that they didn't think were possible, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. creating spaces for people experiencing homelessness that you know the red tape wouldn't allow for, and the dismantling or the cutting of some of that red tape during the pandemic out of a sheer necessity, I think was fantastic. I think in youth homelessness, things like the ban on evictions actually provided an opportunity for a reset for youth homelessness where all of a sudden you don't have as – and evictions certainly are leading to young adults experiencing homelessness. You have a reset and an opportunity then for some of the programs that were – built beforehand, prevention programs then to take hold or diversion, you know, diversion to kind of gain hold and actually when you're at that point, you're cutting inflow into homelessness significantly. There's an opportunity to let those prevention programs, I think, catch up. And I think that helped us make some progress in some ways because the inflow wasn't quite as big. Mm-hmm. On the downside, we didn't learn all of the lessons and some of the things that worked incredibly well to reduce poverty and probably homelessness.
And child tax credit. Child poverty.
I mean, we had it's mind-numbing to think we had this one of the best poverty reduction interventions in, you know, forever, and we let that go. I think that we also, in the same way, let go of some of the lessons we learned about that it's actually going to take incredible boldness to end homelessness. Mm-hmm. And that boldness was there during the pandemic. And the humanity that I described in Latin America was there too. Mm-hmm. Because all of a sudden we were all connected. We all felt just that much closer to that person who seemed further away. In Latin America, because poverty, you know, in the countries I was in was much more you know, people experienced a lot more. There was a lot more proximity. There was a proximity, I think, during the pandemic to homelessness that people understood, and we've let that go.
Well, and also, especially for young people, the fact of mental illness affecting, you know, all young people pretty much. I mean, obviously disproportionately if they were struggling with housing insecurity, food insecurity, but the massive importance of school-based counseling and other kinds of supports.
I 100% agree. I think the trauma that young people experienced, whether you call it trauma or just the tension of the pandemic and the uncertainty, any parent can see it in their own kids, regardless of what age their kids were at during the pandemic. The importance for all of our kids to have that support is immense. But I experienced the pandemic without having to worry about my job.
Or access to healthcare.
When we had a healthcare issue during the pandemic, we knew how to work the system. That stressor wasn't there and it wasn't being experienced by my kids. So I think for other young people who are experiencing housing instability, who are experiencing economic instability, my sense is they experienced the pandemic in a way that was exponentially more traumatic. And I think about how traumatic it was for us. I remember in the first 2 weeks setting up a two-week Olympic kind of competition for my kids. And I'm like, once it's done, once we finish done. The ill-thought-out javelin throw, we'd be back in school and it'd all be normal. And as it, you know, as months turned into years, it was really hard, I think, for all of us. And I thought about that the same way I thought about the first few months of having a newborn baby of, man, if I didn't have the economic stability and the parent who could support me, I started to understand a little bit more understand other people's situations a little bit more. Why does child abuse happen? So to think about that, like the trauma that our family was feeling with all these supports, to not have that was horrifying.
Yeah.
So we are on the brink certainly of more and more young people responding to that trauma in a way that destabilizes their housing, and we have to make sure that our supports for them in terms of their mental health are beyond what we could have imagined. And that would be a lesson I would take away from the pandemic is we actually have to be bold around that. And this is we can't wait. I would worry that what we'll do is as homelessness grew in the U.S., that we'll just wait until it's out of control. And then we'll try and create a system that cleans it up.
Recreate a system.
Right.
We didn't learn from the first.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's my worry. I think the hopeful note at this point in the story is that we're not doing that as a state. And the federal government at this point is also not doing mm-hmm. that. They are mm-hmm. continuing on a bold push that is paying off, that is really reducing youth homelessness mm-hmm. in a lot of communities, but particularly Washington State. And the thing that we try to continue saying is that, again, if you're seeing fewer young people on the streets of Seattle now, if we keep that up, we're going to see fewer adults mm-hmm. on the streets in just a few years. And these are not disconnected issues. Mm-hmm. Statistics tell us that. And maybe more importantly, if you go talk to people who are experiencing homelessness on our streets, they'll tell you
yes.
that too.
Yeah, almost universally. Yeah. And also that we know what works.
For sure.
Both for reducing veteran homelessness, which has been huge. And now youth homelessness, especially in Washington State.
We really do. We do know what works, and it's not that expensive to do more of that.
And it helps everybody again.
It does. It does.
Entire communities.
Yeah. Yeah. I think our barrier is a political system that often electeds, and I get this, need to show progress within 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a problem that is deep. We know it works, but we've seen this both in your kind of average citizen who calls and says, I still see that mm-hmm. person on the porch on the mm-hmm. way to work. So don't tell me that homelessness is being reduced when you're like, well, actually it is. I know that person's still there, but actually it's going down. Well, it doesn't matter. It's what you see right in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
We see that also among advocates who don't want to celebrate good news because they don't want to devalue the experience that they're seeing their friends have. And they're like, don't forget about them.
Or wanting to reduce the momentum. I mean, similar to climate collapse.
That's right.
People don't want to publicize good news because then everybody is like,
Take the foot off the gas pedal for sure. Do we still have gas pedals? I think we do.
I don't know what you do with electric cars.
That's right. I think that's still an electric pedal. I don't know what it is. Yeah, I'll have to come up with a new euphemism, which, again, we've been around so long, we're going to just have to start inventing new new phrases.
Right.
Yeah.
So just kind of in wrapping up, is there anything else that I didn't ask you that you wanted to add right here at the end?
I don't think so. I talked about almost everything. I think I would say maybe in wrap up, what is frustrating about youth homelessness is that it is, like I said, a symptom of a lot of broken mm-hmm. systems. There are few examples that are better than that we have created systems that just don't work for young people, or they're operating as intended, and they were never intended to work for these young people. What's exciting about that is that if we can get it right on youth homelessness, and I think we really believe this at the foundation, we've got a roadmap for solving a lot of other problems that are truly intersectional mm-hmm. as well. Some of the lessons that we're learning around youth homelessness, which is, it's got to be clear who in government's responsible mm-hmm. for it. You got to have good data. You got to have solutions that people who are experiencing that mm-hmm. issue are involved in creating. That philanthropy can play a role, but ultimately it can only play a small role. And its role really should be around changing the system rather than filling little holes that government really won't be doing. Those are true if we're trying to reduce the number of young people who are being arrested and mm-hmm. incarcerated. That's largely true if you're trying to make sure that you get better healthcare outcomes for young people.
Including behavioral health.
Including behavioral. It's true if you want to reduce suspensions and expulsions.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, to me, that you asked why I came to this, it wasn't because I or, you know, my family had experienced youth homelessness. It was such a mind-blowing problem that didn't seem like it should exist, that I think that if we can solve this, and I do think we can, I think we've got the data to show we're on the path, very few problems that exist in our country are intractable. They can follow the same roadmap. And in fact, just like we're following the roadmap of other systems change leaders and that have come before us. And so that part, I think, is hopeful and exciting. And I think we're on the right track, but we will no doubt face setbacks and go backwards before we go forwards again.
Well, Casey, it's been a pleasure to see you again and to hear more of your story. Appreciate your time and also all of the amazing work that you have done and continue to do.
Thank you. It's so nice to reconnect after all these many years.
Right.